Welcome to Grounding, conversations on mental health and Mother Earth. I'm Sarah Aronson, a psychotherapist practicing in Missoula, Montana, and a member of the Climate Psychology Alliance North America. In this series, we work to better understand the emotional experiences we have as we react to the changing climate around us. Our guests today are Dr. Robin Cooper, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at UC San Francisco Medical School and founder of the Climate Psychiatry Alliance, and Michelle Ubaraga, environmental attorney and head of Montana's chapter of Moms Clean Air Force. We'll also hear from the writer, environmentalist, and interdisciplinary artist Priya Sabharwal. Together, they'll help us understand how air pollution and wildfire smoke impact how we feel, connect with each other and our surroundings, and in Priya's case, how we translate that understanding into art.
I have this beef with ideas of the apocalypse. And yeah, the idea that like we're kind of hurtling towards the end. I think it's deeply uncreative. I don't know, the end of your world is not the end of the world.
How does this notion, as Priya stated, that we're hurtling towards the end, direct the ways that we're living and feeling in this moment? And how does it direct the ways we're attempting to affect change? To help answer these questions, I spoke with Dr. Robin Cooper, whose interest in climate change and its impacts on mental health comes from her many years of work in climate change politics. As a note, this episode contains references to mental health issues, including suicide, so please take care of yourself when listening. Define air pollution and its sources.
The sources of air pollution are a part of our modern lives. They happen from industry sources. They happen from oil drilling and refineries, which are a major source of air pollution and a driver of climate change. The automobiles that we use, and all of us do, are major sources of air pollution. Airplane flights are sources of air pollution. There are so many aspects of the contribution to just plain dirty air that are woven into our lives. And of course, then wildfires are one component. Air pollutant from wildfires have the chemical contributions from burning down forests, but we are now living more and more in that wildland-urban interface. We live there. We want to live there. But that means when there are wildfires, there are not only the burning of the forest, but there is everything that is in our homes. And that's plastics and pesticides and solvents and all of the things that we use for cleaning our homes and volatile metals and propane. So we have this contribution of both the natural burning from the forests and all of these other pollutants that make air pollution probably the most significant and dangerous of air pollution exposure. It's a really nasty mixture.
So what is dirty air on a molecular level? Air pollution is measured both by its toxicity and size. Pollution where the particles are less than 2.5 microns in diameter, or PM2.5, are called ultrafine particles and can be as tiny as 1/50th the width of a single human hair. I've heard you say that just breathing, the essence of life, brings these particles into our brains. I'm imagining these ultrafine particles as cartoon villains. Can you just sort of give listeners a picture of what they're like?
I love your image of these little monsters entering our brain. They are so tiny that we can only see them with very advanced microscopes. And they're sticky and gooey, and they clump together. And it's that clumping together that may also promote the inflammatory reaction. We have standards for air pollution at the 2.5 level that the Environmental Protection Agency has set. There are no standards for these ultrafine particles. There are none. So we have no guidelines. Also, communities don't measure them. So we don't know always our exposure level to these ultrafine particles. And I say those are the ones that are most damaging to our bodies and our brains.
Michelle Ubaraga, head of the Montana chapter of Moms Clean Air Force, also sounded an alarm about the deficiencies in how we track and measure air pollution in our communities on a day-to-day basis. Is there a way that you measure air quality index based on your landscape? Is it like, if we can see this mountain,
yes,
then it's safe-ish?
Yeah, that's, I had a, one of my girlfriends was the health director for the county for a little while. And so I remember asking her, and her son has asthma, and I was asking her about how do we measure as a community, whether our kids are playing outside at recess or practicing or, and she told me, like, oh, we really don't. And yeah, it is kind of, can you see, we've got Livingston Peak, like, can you see Livingston Peak? It's really unscientific. And we need to have some better tools for measuring wildfire smoke. As you know, Montana is a very big state. Some communities have air monitors from the Department of Environmental Quality. The closest one for us is over in Bozeman. It's a mountain pass away. It's a completely different, you know, it's not reliable as far as what's happening here. So those purple air quality monitors are useful. But I think that Montanans are also pretty hardy. So maybe when we should be staying inside, people aren't.
I'm starting to get a picture of what air pollution is, what I'm exposed to on hazy and smoky days. But what effect is this having on me, my body, my brain, when I breathe dirty air? Can you also begin by describing the overall picture of air pollution and its impact on folks globally?
Well, air pollution is one of the most significant public health concerns of our time. It causes profound disability, and as I say, is one of the biggest killers. The impacts are vast in terms of health, pulmonary impacts, asthma, cardiovascular, but what is less known are the air pollutant impacts on our brains directly. And that's where the intersection between what I do, the brain's control center for mental health, but also thinking and behavior.
Most of us know that air pollution impacts our lungs, but what Robin explains is how it also affects our brains, especially in the very young and the aging.
Breathing in dirty air is going straight into our brains and has a profound impact on our brain function, particularly for vulnerable groups. Everyone is impacted, but not equally. We know that air pollution can aggravate and intensify, not cause, but make worse, add to all of the mental health impacts of the aging brain. So dementias, Parkinson's, maybe even ALS can be aggravated by air pollution for the elderly. Then at the completely other end of the developmental spectrum, exposure to air pollution for pregnant women is a very severe and has been shown to cause damage to the developing fetus. And then little kids, babies, toddlers, and children are also impacted by those air pollutants with troubles with behavior, IQ, attentional issues.
How does air pollution and wildfire affect how we think and feel?
Living through a wildfire is a major contributor to post-traumatic stress disorder and shakes people to the core. And young people, again, and elderly, those who can't take care of themselves without being dependent on others, are rattled and can come out with long-term experiences of post-traumatic stress and depression.
And here in Montana, we host another group that is often vulnerable to the adverse psychological impacts of wildfires. We're lucky to be the home base of a number of what are called interregional hotshot crews. These hotshots, wildland firefighters responsible for performing some of the most hazardous and demanding tasks in the field, they often suffer from depression, post-traumatic stress, substance abuse, and at times, suicide. For those of us not on the front lines, though, sometimes our reaction to the trauma of wildfires plays out in a markedly different way. When our brains anticipate trauma, our mental and emotional coping mechanisms kick in. And in some cases, this might look like a denial of the reality around us. That might mean ignoring the geographic or financial privilege we carry in the world, believing that what is happening outside of our hyper-local bubbles does not or cannot affect us. What are the psychiatric or psychological processes that sort of reinforce our ability to pretend as if we are not in this greater context?
The luxury of living in what we call disavowal, which is a different than just denial. Denial is, I don't see the facts. Disavowal is, I know the facts, but it's not going to happen to me. I am buffered. That's a lovely place to be psychologically because it buffers a sense of being tormented. How do we hold really experiencing troubling feelings and connecting with that, not being consumed and not experiencing it every day, every minute, but holding really, really profoundly troubling feelings, modulating real troubling feelings so that they can be tolerated. That allows us then to have a broader sense of empathy, compassion, and connection. It is a really mature psychological task to be able to be in that in-between space of tolerating really big, troubling emotions and not being devastated by them or needing to retreat into a fantasy of well-being.
As with all of our guests on Grounding, the conversations we had on the mic were not the only conversations we had. There was a lot going on behind the scenes. And after Robin and I recorded our conversation, she expressed some regret about not explaining certain nuances of risk and resiliency, specifically as it has to do with wealth in Montana's many indigenous tribes.
Within the state of Montana alone, there are 8 federally recognized tribal nations, 7 reservations, and 12 major tribes. Racial and ethnic minorities and those with low income face a greater vulnerability to wildfires compared with primarily white communities and those with greater wealth. Those with considerable wealth often choose to live in beautiful natural places that are also fire-prone areas. Yet despite the risk that they choose to take, this fact threatens to overshadow the disparities of risk and the devastating impacts of wildfires, especially those suffered by the indigenous tribes who live in those fire-prone areas also, but lack the wealth and the financial resources to prepare for or recover from fires.
It is a persistent theme throughout conversations we've had in producing Grounding that people with privileged positions in our society are able to more easily soften their lived experience of climate change, while those closer to the margins struggle to mitigate the effects. Wildfire smoke is one of the climate impacts where I tend to hear people use the word apocalypse or apocalyptic to describe the most. And I'm just wondering, how do we hold a vision for a new world when the present and the future feel so grim?
That ties into this idea that I've been asked multiple times. How do I experience hope? I ground myself in an idea that holds me. I'm a Jew, and Jews of my age all have the historical experience of the Holocaust as a primary grounding. I had no relatives who experienced the Holocaust. My descendants came here much earlier. It is still the foundational kind of historical experience. And for me, I think those people who stepped up to protect those who were victimized during the Nazi era are the biggest heroes. And they did that at great risk to themselves. And I don't think at the time they did them with the idea that, oh, we're going to succeed to defeat Hitler. He was so profoundly powerful then. They did it because they knew it was right, and they did it because it was the threat at the moment. And that holds me to the climate work. It is not whether we will completely succeed. It is that this is the threat that I know now. I cannot live with myself knowing it without doing something to try to make an attempt to right this.
We spoke earlier of the heroic work of hotshot firefighters. But these public-facing heroes of wildfires here in Montana, in the West, and increasingly elsewhere around the country are not the only heroes that have found in this growing problem of air pollution a reason to gather and advocate for some of the most vulnerable among us. I'm talking, of course, about moms. Moms like Michelle Ubaraga. Will you talk a little bit about Moms Clean Air Force?
It's a community of more than a million parents across the country. And we work on, you know, protecting our children's health from air pollution. And I think the biggest threat to our children's future, climate change. And we do that in a lot of different ways. You know, the gathering in communities to talk. We know that we can move the needle by having conversations in community. So we do a lot of that. I moved to Montana in 2004, and it wasn't, I don't think we were talking about wildfire season like we are now. I mean, fire is a natural part of the ecosystem, but the frequency, the duration has certainly just been increasing in the past 10 years. My son's born in August. So it was his first birthday. There was a big fire nearby, and we were going to go down to the river and swim or something. And instead, we drove down the valley, Paradise Valley, and watched the hillside burning, went home.
Right now, I am in the Elkhorn Mountains, about 10 miles south of Helena, Montana. It's really close to where I grew up, actually, about 5-7 some miles down the road. In 1988, the year I was born, a fire tore through this landscape, and you can still see, even now, where it burned. There's a distinct difference in the color of the trees that grew from that burned area. They're a much lighter, kind of duller green. It's up here in the Elkhorns, on this landscape of yellowing grasses, where my body feels most at home, especially maybe in the warm seasons. My mind is quiet, and all I can think of up here is how my past and my present are sort of able to live in my body without tension.
That was grounding producer Lauren Korn, sending us an audio postcard from her landscape of origin outside Helena, Montana.
We're still learning to live with wildfire, and what does that mean? I was just talking to a group of parents about an hour ago, and we were talking about getting ready for wildfire season and how folks on the East Coast, so many people experienced wildfire this year that have never before. And so they're learning about the impacts, how serious, and they were talking about having their children wear masks outside. You know, we're not that good about it in Montana, right? I mean, our kids are still playing soccer, playing outside, practicing. My sister was jogging all through this like season of smoke, and I kept telling her, like, you probably shouldn't be running outside. But we do, right? We just kind of live with it.
This is Montana, big sky country. We, as residents of this state, pride ourselves on being resilient, living in a rugged landscape, and responding in kind. But taking care of ourselves in these spaces must also mean attending to our bodies during wildfire season, doing our best to breathe clean air.
My friends that are working on these issues, when it gets smoky, it just feels like, you don't want to get out of bed, right?
Yeah, it's almost like in a sort of an acute version of this longer term issue of like, how do we just keep, again, adapting and getting out of bed and doing the hard work and waiting for a clean air day that we can catch our breath and sort of restabilize. Yeah. People in cities aren't used to wildfires in the same ways we are here in Montana, and they're more likely to pay attention to the ways air pollution like smoke is impacting their bodies. But I think here in the West, we're going to have to change our behavior which will also mean grieving the loss of that perceived rugged individualism or freedom in order to keep ourselves safe.
I was thinking about the Canadian wildfires' impact on New York City and looking at images of people crossing the Brooklyn Bridge with N95 masks on, and the difference maybe between how it can seem in Montana, where we're sort of habituated to wildfire smoke and we try and tough it out on bad air days and we still work outside and recreate outside. So I was wondering, could you offer some gentle guidance for us out here about how we might work to protect ourselves?
You're touching again that area that mama worries. I know my daughter doesn't protect herself adequately during these periods of extreme air pollution and where air quality impacts health. And I think people who have that kind of core sense of I've got to be outside, my life depends on it, are more inclined to ignore and say, I'll tough it out. And I worry about that. These exposures to air pollution are of significant public health concern. And there are ways that we have to alter our lives somewhat during these periods of air pollution. There are serious ways that we need to inform the public about what we do before wildfires for prevention.
And in that effort to inform the public, Robin pointed me to MontanaWildfireSmoke.org as a resource for Montanans. It's a website that tells you the current air quality and goes into great detail about the health risks of wildfire smoke. It also provides a number of ways you can keep yourself and your family healthy indoors and safe outdoors during wildfire season. We also received some advice from Michelle about how to participate in affecting change for those of us who haven't devoted our lives to this cause.
Folks, I think in all walks of life, no matter what their profession, that are asking themselves, what's my role? What can I do? How do I support a better future for my children? I think it's really important to realize that you don't have to do it for your profession. And that actually, like, voices are more impactful if people are volunteering their time and they're showing up, and they're showing up with their kids, speaking from their hearts. That's movement building, and that's what we need to do. And the other thing we talk a lot about is whose voices are being heard. You know, who has a seat at the table? And unfortunately, more powerful decision, you know. I gotta stop for a minute. I don't know. I'm just getting emotional.
Yeah. Take your time, Michelle. And we don't need to rush anything, and we don't need to avoid emotion. We're looking for realness. Because who this is going out to is just listeners across the state who are also feeling the same way, but haven't been invited into these spaces yet. So it matters how you feel.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I've been doing it a long time.
Yeah.
And really, I don't want to be sad about it. And we need people to feel hope.
Yeah.
But I'm really, really grateful to have, you know, a community of women where we can talk about all these things, about what are we worried about, where are we finding hope.
I have a confession to make. I love the smell of wildfire. It makes me homesick. I grew up in the Mountain West, and every summer is smokier than the one before. Brittle lodgepole pines going up in an orange flash, the ashy haze scratching the throat and tearing up the eyes, an assault on all the senses. The thing is, it also smells like breakfast in India, like my grandmother's old house. Chai simmering gently over wood-burning stoves, rotis licked by the flame. It looks like India, too. Sunlight filtering through the smoke in the softest, warmest orange, the polluted haze of our shared smog, a pinkish glow I now know mostly through memory, rose-colored nostalgia, a sunrise that lasts the whole day. Even now, as climate chaos crispens the landscape I call home, I can't help but soften at the smell of things coming undone. Forgive me for loving a burning world. You see, I have no other world. And I have no other love.
That was Priya Sabharwal,
a writer, environmentalist, and interdisciplinary artist currently living in Missoula, reading an excerpt from their untitled poem about wildfire. Grounding producer Lauren Korn sat down with Priya to talk to them about it.
How does your body carry the anticipation of destruction, of this idea of a world we're losing?
Oh, that's a really good question. It makes me think about how I've often heard it be like our ancestors' trauma and what they've gone through is inherited in our bodies. And I think that's true. And I think also, like, along with trauma and grief, there is resilience and there is joy. There's more than just destruction there. Yeah. And so even though there is this inevitability, and I think, yeah, seeing the truth in that inevitability and expecting it sometimes helps soften that blow, but also knowing that that's not the only thing encoded in our bodies. There's also the ability to survive that inevitable destruction in so many different ways.
I'm wondering, Priya, how do the ways that you view the loss of the world, the loss of the natural world, influence the ways that you nurture your relationship to it?
Yeah, I think we are constantly being asked to sit with the end of the world and the apocalypse. And I do think there's only so many mornings that you can wake up at the end of the world and keep going. And after a while, we kind of need a new story. Yeah, I have this beef with ideas of the apocalypse. And yeah, the idea that, like, we're kind of hurtling towards the end. I think it's deeply uncreative. I don't know, the end of your world is not the end of the world. And I think a lot about how there will always be, like, saplings and seedlings and tadpoles and children. And we kind of owe it to them to keep investing in that world building.
You can hear the rest of Priya's poem in the Grounding podcast feed. Let's recap. Air pollution is very serious. And unfortunately, we don't have the greatest ways to measure some of the most harmful particles, those particles smaller than 2.5 microns. Some chemicals and matter can go directly to our brains when we breathe them in, and that can have devastating effects on our cognition and mental health. Be curious and mindful about the air quality in your area. Turn to resources like MontanaWildfireSmoke.org, and when air quality monitors indicate risk, take that risk seriously. Don't expect the air to play along with your soccer practice schedule or your running routine. Make air quality a part of your climate adaptation plan. Stay inside, find alternate ways to exercise and recreate that minimize your exposure, and wear a mask when the air quality is low. For our friends out east, contending with wildfire smoke was new and alarming. And while those of us in the West have become used to these seasonal realities, our complacency can't be our strategy or coping mechanism for weathering these events. Air pollution impacts more than just our respiratory system. It impacts our brains, which changes how we think and feel. Understanding and addressing how our physical selves and our emotional selves intersect is necessary to cope with growing climate anxiety. Lastly, you may find comfort in knowing that what you have to offer means something, even if it doesn't always feel that way. Whether you've made climate advocacy your livelihood, or you're simply a concerned citizen of the world. Grounding is produced by Jake Birch, Lauren Korn, and me, Sarah Aronson. Theme song by Brian Ramirez and artwork by April Whirl. Engineering by Chris Moyles, mixed by Jake Birch. Special thanks to Michael Marsalek, Noah Epps, Emma Booker, Claire Menahan, and Alice Sauter. Grounding is a production of Montana Public Radio. More information can be found online at mtpr.org.